Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Thank you for joining us in this, the latest edition of the OIS podcast series. My name is David Ledesma, and I'm chairman of the GAS programme at the Institute. And it's my great pleasure to be joined today by Michael Maiden, who's director of the GAS and China programmes at the Institute, and Philip Andrew Speed, research fellow at the OIS. And we're here today to discuss the key messages that came from their forthcoming Oxford Energy Forum that they co-edited. Now, just to timestamp this recording in the ever-changing market, we're recording it on the morning of Monday, the 28th of February, 2022. Michael and Philip, welcome back to the OIS podcast series.
David, it's great to be back.
And for me too.
Okay, Michael, perhaps I can come to you first, you know, because this Oxford Energy Forum is very focused on the energy crisis experienced by China in September and October last year. You know, perhaps you could share with our listeners, why is that?
First of all, it was a hugely impactful power outage. I mean, China has seen power crises and outages in the past, but nothing on the scale of what we saw in September and October, where really power curtailments impacted over 20 provinces, and not just industrial, but also residential users, where, you know, were typically the ones to be shielded from any power outages. So the scale of it was significant. It had a global impact in terms of sort of the macroeconomic ramifications and questions about China's role in supply chains. And also within China and outside, of course, questions about the causes, the role of power price distortions, but also policies and the dual control targets. So basically government mandated efforts to limit the increases in energy consumption. So there was a huge amount of debate as to what were the causes of the power crisis. And we wanted to take a bit of time to let the dust settle and reflect on what happened. But also the way it was perceived, and so this sort of post-mortem and what it is leading to now, discussions about energy security, the role of coal, the role of renewables, and also the pace of the energy transition. And we wanted to discuss whether or not these power outages had any implications for this broader policy, energy policy thinking.
So, Philip, coming to you then, you know, what were the symptoms, therefore, of the crisis?
Well, really, building on what Michael said, I mean, the lights were going out across much of China, at least for a while. And actually, in the northeast, the traffic lights were off. People were getting stuck in lifts. So, you know, the daily domestic life and people's life was severely disrupted. In addition, then, you know, in certain areas, the factories and other industrial plants were turned off. So it looked as if the whole economy might just grind to a halt. It was that serious.
Okay, so it appears from the forum that there seem to be multiple causes. Michael, perhaps I can come to you. You know, can you tell us, you know, what was going on in the coal industry then?
So what we had was, in a way, a perfect storm of slower supply growth and very strong demand growth. On the supply side, there are actually a number of issues, some of them related to sort of the peak emissions targets and efforts to limit the share of coal in the energy mix gradually. And although, you know, you have to note that coal consumption in China continues to rise, but the share of coal in primary energy mix has declined from around 70% in 2011 to 58% in 2020. So again, there is an increase in coal consumption, but there is a reduction in its share of the energy mix. There is an effort to continue that decline in its share in the energy mix, but also to make production more efficient, to make it safer. There have been issues with worker safety in coal mines for a very long time. So this whole issue of supplies have been constrained domestically. There was a coal ban on Australian imports, so even the imports were constrained. But at the same time, demand growth was extremely strong due to a robust recovery in economic activity. So we had a perfect storm in the market. At the same time, we have pricing distortions whereby electricity prices are capped or set by the state, and therefore the pass-through of rising international coal prices was not passed on to end users, which made coal buyers and generators shut down for maintenance, reduce their stocks, and therefore tighten the market even more. So it was a perfect market storm, but there's also, as one of the pieces in the forum argues, there was this lack of coordination in policy. You cannot reduce, arguably, the share of coal in the primary energy mix if you do not have enough reliable supplies of alternative sources of energy at the ready. So, you know, when we look at China on an overall basis, it is amply supplied and coal-fired generation is operating at 50% of capacity often. But at peak times and in certain regions, that is still not enough.
Yes, and you mentioned the Australian coal, of course, which is a political decision. And we're recording this, as I said, on Monday, the 28th of February, when in Europe, you know, we're facing considerable political uncertainty as well, which is what I think is quite interesting. Philip, you know, if I can come back to you, how did kind of the story that Mikhail's just given us with coal feed into the power industry?
Well, I think just to expand on what Mikhail said, the coal market, the domestic coal market, has been largely liberalized since the late 1990s. And so the price is broadly set by supply and demand, though there have been annual agreements between big coal mines and big coal power generators in the past. And although the coal market is almost liberalized, the electricity market is not. And prices for coal-fired generation have been fixed. And in fact, traditionally, it was a fixed price for a fixed number of hours per year. This has been allowed a certain amount of fluctuation by 10% up and down until recently, but 10% variation was not enough for the power generators. And so, you know, if the price of coal doubles and your price as a generator only goes up 10%, you have a problem. So what do? You stop buying coal, you stop generating, and you claim you're on maintenance. So although there was a shortage of coal, the price goes up, the power generators said, this isn't our business. So they stopped buying coal, coal stocks dropped at coal-fired power plants, and many of them stopped selling electricity.
Mikhail, therefore, can I come back to you then? Because some people say that the government's dual control policy on energy consumption, energy intensity, really contributed to the crisis. You know, what's your view on that?
I think initially, in a lot of the press coverage and in also some of the commentary coming out of China, it attributed the energy outage to these policies and said, well, you know, a number of provinces haven't hit their targets and are therefore shutting down power supplies in order to try and meet their targets. But actually what we've seen, and some of the pieces in the Oxford Energy Forum address this, is that the northern provinces were on track to meeting their targets. This wasn't an issue. This was more of an issue in the southern provinces. So the dual control targets were a minor contributor to the outages. They weren't really the causes. The causes were very much as Philip has just described them. But more broadly, I think this issue of the dual control policy and these mixed signals that had come from the central government, and I would argue continue to come from the central argument, are critical in the lack of coordination and in some of these disruptions that we are likely to see going forward in China's energy sector. Because on one hand, the government is saying your mandate now is to become cleaner, it is to phase out fossil fuels. Some provinces are trying to do this quite rapidly and introduce renewable energy, and they're looking to restructure their sort of industrial base. All this is great for the energy transition, but there has been so much pressure, it is politically correct to pursue the energy transition with great vigor, that to a certain degree, I wonder if it wasn't politically correct to forecast strong demand growth for electricity and for energy more broadly in China. And if you're not forecasting strong demand growth, then you're not able to assure that supplies are there. And so now we're getting signals from the government again that are saying, you know, we have to adjust and we have to realistically assess the conditions and adapt the energy transition to it, because this sort of overzealous implementation of sort of the 30-60 targets are in part contributing to this. So in that respect, I would say that the dual control targets were a contributor to the power crisis, even though it wasn't the, you know, trying to meet a specific number that led to the power shortages.
Well, Mikhail, staying with you, if I can, you mentioned strong demand growth, but what was the role of the post-COVID economic recovery in all of this?
I mean, I think it was, you know, precisely that misaligned signal, so to speak, right? There was just very strong economic activity. The government sort of supported infrastructure development. There was the cooling of the real estate sector only really started towards the end of the year. A lot of other Asian manufacturers that were still hampered by the pandemic sort of moved manufacturing or manufacturing moved back to China because of those constraints in other countries. And therefore, there was just very solid economic activity. Again, where China was back up and running well before many other countries were. So in that respect, the post-COVID recovery, again, and the strong demand contributed to this appetite for energy. But perhaps, again, a greater emphasis should be put on the fact that very few people in China seem to have been forecasting this and therefore preparing for this.
Okay. So, Philip, you know, can I come back to you about kind of the government response to the crisis, you know? And in your opinion, you know, was the government successful in actually resolving it?
Well, the government moved in pretty sharply in a big way, both on coal and power. I mean, to put it simply, they told the coal miners to produce more coal and lower their prices. So the market mechanism was manipulated, shall we say, in favour of the state and in favour of stability. And those coal mines where production might have been suspended or capacity had been reduced were now allowed to produce more coal. And also new mines and new mine capacity in existing mines are being brought online. So this is not just, you know, produce more coal today, but it's get ready to produce more coal tomorrow and the day after, as well as make sure, and there was a reminder end of last week, don't put the prices up too much. And remember, these are state-owned coal mines at provincial level. So if the head of the mine doesn't keep his prices down, he will lose his job. In the power sector, again, they said produce power if we produce, give you coal. And they did allow the price range to move up by 20%, which is better than 10%. It still didn't necessarily reflect the price of coal, but it was better. And, you know, the order went out, all coal-fired generators must sell onto the wholesale market, but that's still within the 20% range. So, yes, I mean, the government acted, and as far as we can see, largely the crisis is over. It's a bit difficult to judge because you had Chinese New Year at the beginning of February when everybody goes home anyway. Then you had the Olympics when all the factories were shut. So, yeah, I would say it's too early to tell whether the short-term impact have completely faded away, but certainly that sense of crisis seems to have gone. But at the same time, as Mikhail alluded to, you know, energy security is now ever more at the top of the energy agenda. And if that means we produce more coal, so be it. That seems to me what I'm seeing. So it was successful, but, you know, the cost is there will be more coal being produced.
Yeah, and again, just to repeat, we are recording this podcast on Monday the 28th of February, where energy security, potential greater use of coal in Europe as well is very, very clearly on the agenda. Well, look, why don't I kind of perhaps come to you both on a question kind of about the future developments of the country's energy sector, you know, energy consumption, energy mix, and also the role of markets. So, now, what are the implications of what's happened on that? Mikhail, why don't I come to you first for your views?
I think if I pick up on what Philip was just saying about energy security, that has really resonated very strongly. All the official government guidance and the outlooks for 2022, one of the most salient points on there is energy security and therefore coal. But equally, these questions of demand side management, energy efficiency, right? All these, I mean, I think, you know, we are talking a lot about how energy security is leading to more coal and to perhaps a slower movement towards the 2030 and the 2060 targets. They are still very present. I mean, I don't think that they have gone away. I don't think that the government's ambition to reach net zero or to even peak emissions before 2030 have disappeared. On the contrary, but it is a question of how to sequence it and how to make sure that the transition is, well, sustainable from an economic perspective as well. So the focus on energy security, I think, is being defined in lots of different ways. And actually, one of the reasons when we thought about this issue of the forum, the natural choice would have been to do the 14th five-year plan, which is still in the making and a lot of policy documents are being issued. But we were a little concerned that some of those policy documents would be delayed and that they wouldn't all be out while we were writing. And part of that is also the energy crisis. I'm not saying that there's a fundamental rethink of energy policy, but there are tweaks, again, to the sequencing, to the progress, to the ambition. You know, we're hearing a lot about this need to build additional supplies, to add supplies before phasing out coal, whereas there was this debate about, you know, break first, then add, or sort of do not break, but add. There's a lot of the terminology in the phraseology that the Communist Party is using. Again, it shows that debate about how to sequence things. The other implication or another area of focus, of course, that we look at quite closely is gas. And at the height of the power outages, there was a concern very much in Europe that sort of China would now have a dash for gas, right? That it would need to import as much LNG as possible in order to mitigate the crisis. Now, gas in power is a small part of the energy mix and the switchability is much more limited than it is in Europe. And so really the dash for gas was not just because of the power crisis. It was really this broader recovery in energy demand and in the economy in China throughout last year. Q4, when there was a host of deals that were signed with US suppliers, but also more broadly global suppliers, actually, I think, was a response to the volatility in global prices, to the concerns that there would be growing competition with Europe for LNG. And if anything, what we're seeing today, this might be the case going forward. If we get lower pipeline, sort of Russian pipeline supplies into Europe, then there will be greater competition for global LNG with China. And so a rush to secure term deals for LNG should actually be seen in that context. So there are a lot of moving pieces, and these questions about the future developments of the country's energy sector, I think, are varied. Those are the two that I wanted to discuss to begin with. I'll let Philip pick up on a few more.
Yeah, Philip, well, why don't you can you build on kind of what Mikhail's just said with your views?
Well, I think I'll pick up on, you know, the future of energy markets, domestic energy markets within China. And we've already talked about the coal market, which was broadly a liberalized market until there's a crisis and then the government stepped in. The power market, you know, which has been talked about really since the late 1990s and then 2003, it's moving forward very slowly within these very tight price limits. As I've described before, that the government, whether at national or local level, has a way of interfering in these power markets all the time and not necessarily at times of crisis. And then, of course, you've got the emissions trading system, which you've had discussions on podcasts here in the Oxford Institute. And again, I'm very suspicious of those, because if local governments and state companies can manipulate those, manipulate power markets, they're going to manipulate emissions trading systems. And I think it was very interesting in the reports that came out at the end of 2021 that the majority of the major sales of credits came between subsidiaries of the same state-owned groups at nice low prices. So I think if we look forward to the development of energy markets in China, it will continue to be incremental change with occasional steps back.
Philip, can I stay with you perhaps to to build upon the discussion kind of on emissions. You know, what are the implications for the pledges being made for carbon emissions by reduction by 2030 and achieving carbon neutrality by 2060?
Well, I think the 2030 target is most commentators would agree that they should peak before then. As Mikhail has said, maybe this sort of, I won't say a dash for coal, but a slight surge of interest in coal might delay that. But I think I'd go back to the origins of this crisis and, of course, to the power crisis in 2003, which is it's the economy, stupid. So if the economy suddenly surges again, that will further delay. And so the government has this tension between we want the economy to grow sufficiently to keep people employed, social stability, but we don't want it to grow so fast that it screws up our target to peak emissions before 2030. I will leave carbon neutrality a very sophisticated question to Mikhail.
Okay, well, nicely passed the ball. Mikhail, I think you're going to get the final word of the podcast. Over to you then.
Well, I'm going to make sure that I don't answer the sophisticated question as I'm getting the final word. But I would certainly agree that this notion of kind of one step forward, two steps back, I think is very much the sentiment so far from the fallout of the power crisis. And it also combines with the fact that 2020 is a hugely important political year. We have a leadership transition at the end of the year where Xi Jinping is likely to be signed, well, to be voted in for an unprecedented third term in office. And so everything needs to be just right this year. And that means economic stability. It also means blue skies as well. But it does suggest that this focus on getting the right balance of economic activity, of not going too fast on the energy transition, and trying to coordinate. I think this issue of coordination of the various policies, so it does mean that it will come from the top, because the top leadership wants to try and coordinate. And so that is why I think it is taking a step back in some of these reform items by just trying to signal that everything has to go in a slightly more thoughtful and perhaps cautious manner. But that is being translated in the provinces. And again, we go back to this issue of mixed signals. The provinces now have perhaps less of an incentive to push forward with an aggressive timeframe, not just for the peaking by 2030. Again, it could be if China were to go very aggressive on this, China could probably peak in 2026 or 2027. But if it is a bit more cautious, then we will get by 2030, meaning around 2029. That then sets the stage for net zero by 2060, which China will define the metrics and will therefore achieve them. But it will be determined by this caution and these mixed signals that right now could lead us very much back. I feel last year it felt as though there was a huge amount of progress, right? A lot of policy documents, a lot of price reforms, a lot of efforts to move ahead, both with market mechanisms, but also administrative mandates to really accelerate the energy transition. And again, that perhaps took a life of its own and went too far in creating distortions. Now I think there is a risk that we go too far back in stopping that momentum. Again, I think the overall targets of achieving carbon neutrality, those are not just rhetoric. I think the government recognizes that it needs to do that also for the sustainability of its economic and industrial model and therefore its political legitimacy. So it will be pursued. But it is these pendulum swings of how quickly do you go and how aggressively do you signal this to the market? I think we're taking a step back in slowing it a little bit.
Well, as always, Mikhail and Philip, you know, I've really enjoyed our discussion today. And just things like just how huge the country is in China and how the kind of getting a common policy and a move forward in such a country is really very challenging indeed. And certainly, you know, our conversation today builds on the messages from the forthcoming Ox Energy Forum, the 2021 energy crisis implication for China's energy market and policies. Well, I hope you've all enjoyed listening to this podcast. Thank you and goodbye to everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as all our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our oil, gas, electricity or China programmes, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.